Welcome, everyone, to our JCC class, Coffee, Cake, and Learning, Genesis, The Invisible Touch. It's our first time back after all the Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, well, really, Sukkot, and all the Jewish holidays that we celebrate. I hope everyone had a wonderful time. It's great to be back here in action. So we're going to talk about creation itself. Source one. So God, on day number one, says the following. Actually, this is day two, is one, I inverted it, and day two, the second one is actually what he said on day one. So day two, God said on day two, let there be an expanse. The Hebrew word is rakia, kind of sometimes you've heard it translated in old English Hebrew translations as firmament. So here it chooses the word expanse. I don't know what either one means in the context, but whatever. Let there be an expanse. Betoch hamayim, in the midst of the water, that it may separate water from water. God made the expanse, and it separated the water which was below the expanse from the water which was above the expanse, and it was so. Genesis 1, verses 6 and 7. So here is the question. The rabbis here, those rabbis, they go out to lunch here on that verse, and they say, it teaches you a profound lesson. There is a tragic Jewish and non-Jewish plague called machloket, dispute, division, divide. And in Judaism, it becomes so palpably relevant that we actually have jokes. You know, like, I'm sure you've heard this little joke, the Robinson Crusoe Jew is on an island for 5 years by himself. But he's like an entrepreneurial builder. So when they finally rescue the poor guy after 5 years, he's built a whole like infrastructure there on this little island all by himself. And he's given the rescuers a tour before he leaves his little residence for the last 5 years. And they're walking by, and there's like a little Gilligan's Isle style civilization, right? The professor's there, and Ginger, you know, and the Howells, of course, Thurston Howell III, you know, right, okay. By the way, did you ever notice in Gilligan's Island that even though the Howells have no money, they still are the rich guys on the island? I don't know how that works, but it's sort of like attitude, right? All right, so he comes to Gilligan's Island, and the Jewish guy's giving them a tour, and he says, look at this beautiful synagogue, I made a temple. And he gives them a little tour of the nice little sort of, you know, version of a temple on Gilligan's Island. And they're walking around, and they see another building looks very similar to the first construction. So the guys who are the rescuers say, well, what's that? He goes, that's another temple I built. So they look at him and say, sir, I don't understand. You're all alone. You're one Jew. Why would you go to the trouble of building two synagogues? He goes, you don't understand. This temple's the one I go to every Saturday morning. That one I never set foot in. So again, we make a humorous story out of something that's not such a humorous thing when we have division within the Jewish people. There's a lot of division, as you know, in Israel right now between Jew and Jew. It's not a healthy thing. In America, we have lots of divisions between different parts of our society. It's an unhealthy thing. How unhealthy is it? So the rabbis talk about the concept of a machloket. It's kosher if the dispute is for the sake of heaven. So if it's a kosher dispute for the sake of heaven, then it will endure, it will be successful, it'll bring blessing to the world. But if it's a dispute that is not for the sake of heaven, it's going to blow everybody up involved in the dispute, and ultimately everyone's going to go to H-E-L-L, or as we used to call it in fourth grade, the place where the fun stops. Gehenim, right? And then the rabbis discussed like what that would mean. We gave a talk months ago, which I'm sure you remember, about Korach, Moses' cousin. We spoke about that in depth. But how does that relate to day two? So on day two, God creates our universe, our world. And apparently the earth was just water above and below. And this is in advance of any dry land or any vegetation. So we're in the primal stage of creation. And God says we have to separate waters so that there should be a distinction from water above and below. And that would sort of lay the seeds, both literally and metaphorically, for the rest of creation. But even so, even though it is division between water and water, that is a necessity for creation itself, we spoke about this in Shabbat, if you recall, so anyone here, you'll forgive me for going over this, that we said that even though it's for the sake of a heavenly purpose, creation itself is a heavenly purpose, it's not good. How do we know it's not good? It's not desirable. Because God refrains from calling that act of creation, the water here and the water there, he does not use the word good. There's no word tov on day two. So day three, he uses the word tov twice to make up for the absence of the word good on day number two. So there's no good. Okay. So it's interesting, right, the idea, okay, God's creating the universe, and he's giving a primal act of creation, water above, water below. And even though it's for the sake of a noble purpose, he's teaching us. In other words, God is anthropomorphizing himself to say that if it's not good for creation itself, which you would sort of assume would be a necessity and a noble purpose, however much more so if you humans divide yourselves for less than noble purposes. Yeah? There's only one small problem with this theory. There was already an act that preceded day two, meaning day one of creation, and it uses the word division, and guess what word it uses? Good. God says it was a good action, even though it's a division. Look at source two. This is day one, one of the most famous moments of creation. Vayehi or. God said, Vayehi or, let there be light. Yehi or, let there be light. Vayehi or, and there was light. God saw that the light was, and there's that word, good, tov. And look at the next words, though. And God separated the light, the or, from the darkness, the choshech. That's Genesis 1, 3 to 4. So even if you're not big on arithmetic, Genesis 1, 3, and 4 comes before Genesis 1, 6, and 7. So why are they all going crazy on day 2? Well, water here and water there, and you're dividing it. It's like we can't use the word good. But the first act of creation was light. And you said it was good, even though it separated light from darkness. So what's going on? So here is the approach that I believe is just powerful, and it's very relevant today. Okay. If you're dividing between light and darkness, why is it tov? Why is it good? Because light and darkness are metaphors for good and evil. Light and darkness. So not only is it healthy, it is a necessity. It's a command. We must always divide. We must say out loud, this is not good. This is bad. This is evil. We don't go there. It's your job to differentiate and divide between or and choshech, light, goodness, and choshech, darkness, evil. That's your job. There it's good. It's a necessity. But what about the water? Why is that not good? Why did he leave out the word tov? You know why? Because water and water are both equally good. You had to separate, but there wasn't one part of the water above or below or above that was better than the other. They were like substances. Oh, when you're dealing with things that are like substances, so for example, the Jewish people are all Jewish people. So they're a divide between Jew and Jew. That's not good. So you can't call that a good action. But when it's a divide between Darth Vader and Yoda, or the Emperor and Yoda would be a better analogy. I'm using Star Wars here as my analogy. When it's between the Siths and the Jedi, the Siths are the bad guys, by the way. Darth Vader kind of looks like the bad guy, doesn't he? Yeah. No. Okay. So when it's a divide between good and evil, between the dark side and the Force, you have to call it out and say, no, no, no. The Force, that's what we want. Dark side, no. So how does that relate to today? So it's very powerful. So I'm sure you've all studied and tried to analyze the ceasefire story and what's going on. You're also very much aware that there's been an incredibly profound division in Israel because you have half of Israel, I'm just using half as just an example, half of Israel desperately wanted the whole time to to have the hostages back. I mean, how could you not? I can't even imagine for one second, if God forbid, my child or your child or your husband or wife or someone in your family was imprisoned in a tunnel somewhere with these monsters under Gaza, you would move heaven and earth to redeem them. So that narrative is absolutely truth. But the other narrative, no. We almost lost our country on October 7th of 2023. There's an existential threat here. So that narrative that we have to finish the monsters, but that's also true. That's equally valid. So that would be an example of mayim, water that is like substance. Mayim, water that's like substance, meaning both narratives that divided Israel are both equally true. So God's saying they're both true, but Rahmana Letzlan, which is a nice way of saying God should have mercy on both because they're both true. In other words, if you try to say, well, which side do I weigh in on? I personally would weigh in on both sides. I understand there's a need to eradicate Hamas and there's a need to bring our boys and girls home. They're both true. So there should be a reluctance because they're both equal narratives. But when it comes to identifying good and evil in the world, that's a different ballgame. So if you have people who, I'm just going to say what I believe. If you have people who will say, globalize the Intifada and kill Jews and literally support the terrorists, murderers, and rapists of Hamas. And there are Jews who do this, and there are many non-Jews who do this. I'm sorry, but we need to call them out and say there's good in this world, and there's evil. And that's not good. You may have heard there were, by last count, 800 non-Orthodox rabbis. Because I guarantee you, every single Orthodox rabbi in America would ask the Jews of New York to please not vote for a Hamas guy. Okay? But 800 Reform, conservative, Reconstructionist, men, women, rabbis of every ilk just signed a letter and they publicized it saying, please, you can't do this. You can't do it. You can't vote for somebody who refuses to condemn Hamas and who calls it Israel genocide. I mean, so it's a job of these rabbis to point out. It's their command. When there's Or and Choshev, when there's light and darkness, you have to tell people, this is not light. This is darkness, and you have to point it out. People may not listen, but it's our job according to the Torah. Why is it good when God separated light from darkness? Because it's our primary mission to seek light. And the only way you can seek light is to differentiate what is light and what is darkness. So we have to shout it out, right? So again, I didn't mean to get political. I don't really think it is political at this point. I really think that I'm sure you, like me, are scratching your heads thinking, I don't understand. Can I give you a very powerful analogy? This is kind of harsh. Okay, but I'm going to say it. There were Jews, it's not an exaggeration, who voted for Schicklgruber, Hitler, in that one election. Do you remember? There was one election. And then he abolished and killed every opposition party there was. They got the knocks on the door from the brown shirts and black shirts, and all the opposition in Germany ceased to exist. But here's my analogy, okay? Somebody might respond to you, okay, I'm not really so concerned about Israel, that's far away. Yeah, I'm Jewish, yeah, but you know what? I like the social programs. I like New York needs to be cleaned up. And that's true. That might be very true. But I hate to say this, but you know, Hitler had a lot of things that he espoused that if you're just a German citizen, not Jewish, you say, hey, you know what? We took hits after World War I and the Versailles and rebuilding and bringing back honor to Germans, there are parts of that proposition that may be good, but you're voting for Hitler. I don't understand. I'm not equating, God forbid, this guy with Hitler. But you see the idea that you can't decompartmentalize and say, well, I like the social programs, but I'm going to forgive him for hating Israel. I'm sorry. You have to really, again, I'm not a New Yorker. I'm not voting. You're not voting. But as outsiders, we have to scratch our heads a little bit, like I'm sure you've been doing. Maybe, Doc, you and Rabbi Kaplan have been talking about this in your Wednesday learning.
Actually, we didn't even come up
with this. All right. So that is I'm going to rest my piece at the end of the class. If we want to have a little discussion off the record, I'd be happy to. Because lots of things, I don't know answers. I'm just throwing ideas out, but they're right here in our parsha, so I can't not bring them up. Okay, let's go to source number 3, please. Day number three is the following. Ready? God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, seed, yielding herbs and fruit trees, producing fruit according to its kind in which its seed is found on the earth. And of course, God said it, so it was so. And the earth gave forth vegetation, seed-yielding herbs according to its kind, and trees producing fruit, in which its seed is found according to its kind. And God saw that it was, and there's that word again, good. It was tov. But if you pick apart that verse, did you notice something a little inconsistent? God coded nature. I'm going to use the computer analogy, okay? Because God uses a code. It's the God code, not the Da Vinci code. Okay, sorry, Mr. Brown. The God code means that nature is hardwired to do certain things. So within the confines of nature, he ordered, right? Look what he ordered. He said that both the herbs, meaning grass, vegetation that sprouts up from the ground, it should sprout up, and trees also. But there was something different about the trees. It added a word, trees producing fruit, and look at the next words in the second line, according to its kind in which its seed is found. But when they actually produced God's coding in line number, the end of line two, it says the following. The earth gave forth vegetation, seed yielding herbs according to its kind, trees producing fruit in which its seed is found according to its kind. God never ordered the grass to be to its kind, but it came out that way, didn't it? Now, what does that mean? We have to unpackage this, okay? So plants have, let's call it DNA. I'm not a botanist here. If any of you know a better word for plant DNA, I'm just going to use the word plant DNA, okay? So God gave commands both to the vegetation of the ground, the herbivore, you know, like all the grass, the jishayim, the grass, the vegetation, and he gave specific orders to the fruit trees. By the vegetation, the grass, he just said, please, start to grow. But to the trees, he gave an extra edict. And the extra command was, according each tree, according to its kind. That means apple trees, cherry trees, don't intermingle their DNA. They have to remain distinct. Every type of tree that produces fruit should remain with its kind, limineum, according to its species. Don't cross-mix. Now, I understand that humans, you know, we thought, hey, you know, I love peaches and I love plums, but peaches bruise too easily and plums are a little iffy taste-wise. What if I amalgamated them genetically and made a nectarine, right? So we do stuff like that. But nature is not supposed to do that. We play and genetically graft stuff. Okay, so we're not talking about that. Okay, by the way, in Judaism, we are not allowed to do that. It's called kilayim. We're allowed to, now that nectarine is its own entity, you can eat nectarines. They're totally okay. But we would not graft a peach and a plum to create a new entity, because it's sort of like saying to God, you know, we can one-up you, pal, and we don't want to do that. So there's an actual Torah command called kilayim, mixtures. We're not allowed to plant in a row, like different types of seeds, to weave them into. Once they're done by scientists or experts, and it's been generations and it's its own unique entity, that's a different story. But we as Jews are not allowed to. That's a separate class that I'm not going to go there right now. I see Nancy has a quizzical face.
You have the Jewish scientist who's working in.
Right, it is interesting. It is interesting. But that's another, it's a separate discussion. So here's what God said to the grass. Grow. And to the fruit trees, grow with a caveat, don't share your DNA. Cherries, apples, apart. But what happened? The grass grew, and it did not share its DNA with other grass, just like the fruit trees. So number four, Rashi explains what happened. And you have to really suspend your mind here a little bit to understand what he's saying, because he's talking, obviously, not in a literal way, but in very much of a metaphorical way. And the earth gave forth. Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo ben Yitzchak, the great, formidable Torah commentator, says the following, source 4. Even though, according to its kind, was not said regarding the herbs when they were commanded to grow, meaning when the grass was initially commanded, as we pointed out, it was just told grow. But they, the grass, I like the next word, heard that the trees were commanded thus. And they, the grass, applied a fortiori argument to themselves, a kal vachomer, from minor to major. Okay, so I have to unpackage this for you. So let's pretend that the grass is a person. Okay, what guy's name are you going to give the grass? Come on, Herb. Sorry, I couldn't resist. All right, you come on, you got to love that one. Because I always think, is it Herb or Herb? Okay, Herb, the love bug, right? Herbie the love bug. Wasn't that a little Volkswagen movie? I've had too much coffee, I know. I'm sorry. Mark is thinking, Rabbi, I think you had a Celsius or two. Yeah. But I didn't yet. I'm a little tweaked. I'm just excited to be back teaching Torah again. Okay, so Herb is given the command by God, just grow. And Herb says, wait a minute. And he turns to the herbivores. Sorry. And he says to his famous little musical group, Herb and the Herbivores, right? Little, you know, remember the Herb and the from the 60s? I'm sure there was a group. Okay. So Herb turns to his fellow herbs and he says, now wait a minute. Before we grow, why did God say to the fruit trees that you have to be very careful not to mix your genetics? I don't understand. You see, fruit trees, think about it for a moment. Fruit trees, by definition, have a root system that precludes a tree growing on top of another tree. Unless you want to scientifically, you know, manipulate them. Trees grow apart generally because they have a whole root system. And as you know, if you're a property owner, when the roots start to intermingle, it can cause real issues on the property and on the sidewalk integrity in Kingston. Yeah, good luck when you go walking in Kingston. The, you know, the sidewalks are like 4 feet up this way. I have one. There's one on Dawes that looks like you could have an Olympic diving competition off of it. You know the one I'm talking about? There's one like literally up like this. It's incredible. Anyways, so they have a root system. A root system means that it's impossible for trees to literally grow the way grass can grow with an infinitesimal differentiation between grass and grass. So the grass said, no, wait a minute. In the future, when we grow and we become grass, no human being is going to be able to even identify. When I see grass, there are thousands of species of grass in the world. But for us, who are, at least me, who are not knowledgeable, I see grass, I say, oh, okay, it's grass. I don't know how to differentiate between this grass and that grass. So the grass thought, no, wait a minute. By definition, we, grass, are going to be kind of generic because we're going to kind of just cover everything over. Humans are not even going to take the time to identify us. So we, by definition, are going to grow on top of each other. Those trees, they grow apart. And even though they grow apart, God ordered them, don't share your DNA genetics. So, wow. If God ordered the trees to be careful not to cross-pollinate and grow together, for sure, we grass, who inherently grow on top of each other, we have to follow suit. So on their own, the grass made it up. And they said, you know what? We're going to follow the whatever God said to the trees, we'll do the same thing. So when the reality came and the fruit trees came up, they didn't share genetics. When the grass sprouted up and grew, they followed the lead of the trees. They also did not share DNA. But wait a minute. Who told the grass not to share DNA? God didn't tell them. There was no coding. It wasn't a Windows 11 Bill Gates program. So how did they do that? They followed nature and the logic behind how nature works. Now, I understand that plants and grass are not aware, but it's meant to teach us a lesson. You know what the lesson is? The lesson is that we, as humans, have to be individuals. And you know what God's reaction was when the grass decided not to follow the original order, but on its own decided to like not share other grass DNA? Do you know what God did? He didn't just applaud. There's a prayer, one of the most powerful prayers, because it mentions God's name like 18, 19 times. And it says, in my prayer book, because of the proliferation of God's name, you have to concentrate super hard, like Art Scroll preaches to you. You must concentrate and have tremendous dedication, kafana, when you pray this prayer because of the seriousness of this prayer. And the prayer is right before Ashrei. It's called Yehi Chavod Hashem Leolam. God's glory should be pronounced in the world. Yismach Hashem. God rejoices. He cheers. Yismach b'ma'asav, over his creations. When did God first say out loud, so to speak, bravo, well done, I am so happy that my creations are my creations? You know when he did it? When the grass on its own followed the lead of the trees. Wow. Now what does that mean? It means the following. If God codes creation, nature, right? There's certain elements that just every plant and every animal, every creation of God, they follow the coding of God. It's just perfect. In the same way that when my Apple iOS operating system, and I use that because if it was Windows, I could make a joke, but if my Apple iOS system is like, I mean, it's flawless. So when my phone boots up correctly, I don't sit there like I did years ago with Apple, with Microsoft, I'd be like, yay, Baruch Hashem, thank God I have my computer. I don't have that blue screen of death, right? Okay, so I won't make it about Windows because you might actually cheer when your computer boots up correctly. I know I have a Windows system and I'm happy when it works functionally. But Apple works. By the way, you notice it's Apple tree? Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So when things work out in creation, Mazel tov, congratulations. What else would happen? It's creation. God hardwired creation with coding so that grass grows a certain way, trees grow a certain way, animals hopefully behave in a certain patterns. You have predatory animals and you have the animals running away from the predators very fast. So you don't applaud and say, gee, wow, it's so amazing that the apple seeds grew into an apple tree. Well, I hope so. Or you go back to the company that you bought the apple seeds from and say, guys, you gave me oranges. That's why they don't grow here in the valley, you know? I don't know. But here's the thing. God applauded, if you will, and we're anthropomorphizing in a very big way. When did God applaud for the first time creation? When creation did it on its own. In other words, herbs, and the herbivores decided on their own, whatever that means, to be very distinct from other types of grass, foliage. Now, there's an irony here, right? That they are like indistinguishable one from the other, but we won't even go there. But at least conceptually, the grass followed the lead of the trees. And God said, guess what? That's what I want in creation. But it's not for those lower creations. Who is this designed to teach us the lesson? It's for us. What I'm going to say, I'm going to say very carefully because it sounds heretical. When I said it to my son, the Yeshiva Bachar, I said, Tali, listen very carefully. It's going to sound like heresy, but you have to hear the end. There is one thing in creation that God can't do. You're all like, wow, that is heresy. Because what do you mean God can't do something? God is God. God is omniscient and omnipotent. What do you mean? There's something in creation that God can't do? Yeah, one thing. I have your attention, don't I? You're ready? You're like, whoa. But when you hear it, you'll say, yeah, of course. You see, God cannot make a human being become the human being that they can become. In other words, if God hardwires me to behave a certain way, to have certain instincts that are always going to produce certain results, if he codes me to become Kaplan, and I become Kaplan, that's not a significant development. God can't go, yay, Kaplan turned out to be Kaplan. Mazel tov, you made me a robot. I'm a Terminator. Mazel tov, you coded me. I didn't have any options here. So why are you taking credit? You created a robot. Mazel tov, I followed you. I followed your Torah. I did all the kindness and things. Do you know when God celebrates? When we do something for him, which is the ultimate gift for God. Do you know what that is? When you become yourself. When you become who you could become. Now, don't get me wrong. God gives you the potentiality to be who you are. But he can't force you. You have to choose between the dark side, the choshech, or the light. That is called freedom of choice. Humans are gifted like no other creation under the earth, under the stars, on the earth. We are gifted with the unique freedom of choice. We can make ourselves into devils or angels. If we choose to become fully who we could be, in other words, when you're born, you have all that DNA again, we're getting back to the science, right, and the biology, you have all the potentiality to be something incredible. You know what that is? You. But just like God can't force you to be you, there's no other you in the history of our world. Think about that. Because we're all cumulative results of a breeding program that began all the way back with Adam and Eve and Noah and his wife, right? Everyone is a Ben Noah, a child of Noah. That's this week, right? Because no one else survived the flood except for some giant guy named Og. It was just Noah's family. Na'amah was his wife, and Noah, and Shem, Ham, and Yafet, and their wives. There were just like eight survivors and a big giant. Unless you play for like the Minnesota Timberwolves, you're not part of Og's, the giant's family, okay? Mm-hmm. All right. So getting back then, what can we do for God that he can't do for himself? Become you. By you becoming your individual uniqueness, God can't say to you, you must become and fulfill everything I had envisioned for you. Because then you're not doing it. God's doing it. It's his construction, not you. But he gave us freedom of choice and free will because he wants us desperately. He says, please, please, use what I gave you. Become everything you can become. And when you become something that you could become, that God has envisioned potentially for us, you know what God does? He smiles. He celebrates. Just like he loved when the grass did it on their own, what greater gift can we give to the one who has everything, God, than becoming ourselves, the uniqueness, the individuality? Wow. It's quite unusual, right? All from the grass? Okay, we have just enough time to touch on the last two little things, and we're going to do this very, very fast. Okay, number five, let's get to the Garden of Eden, shall we? All right, we're going to fast forward through creation to the Garden of Eden. God made grow out of the ground every tree that is pleasant to look at and good to eat, including the tree of life in the middle of the garden and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Stop. So that is a narrative description, Google Maps, the original version of the Garden of Eden. So based on this one verse, okay, in source 5, what is the location of the two trees? Because we have a tree of life that is fantastic, the Eitz HaChayim. If you eat from the tree of life, you live forever. And then we have the nefarious Eitz HaDa'at, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So where are they located in the garden? Well, I don't know both of them. I only know one, right? God grew out of the ground every tree. So the garden had every tree imaginable. And the tree of life is betoch hagan. It's in the midst. It's in the middle of the garden, whether it's literally in the middle or just in the center. Okay? Where is the tree of knowledge? I don't know. Doesn't say. It just says, and the tree of knowledge, good and evil, right? So would you agree, based on source 5, we know the exact location of the tree of life, but we don't know where the tree of knowledge was in terms of the garden, right? All right. Let's fast forward to source 6. You want to bend your mind a little bit? The serpent, the Nachash, was the most cunning of all the wild beasts that God had made. The serpent asked the woman, Did God really say that you may not eat from any of the trees of the garden? Meaning he put you here in this beautiful garden, the serpent is saying, and he's mocking her derisively saying, you're an idiot, Adam and Eve. He gave you this beautiful garden and said you can't imbibe, you can't eat anything. Really? The woman, Chava, Eve, replied to the serpent, we may eat from the fruit of the trees of the garden, meaning they're all okay to eat from. But of the fruit of the tree that is in the middle of the garden, God said, do not eat it and do not even touch it, or else you will die. And then the serpent says, you will certainly not die. Do you get the issue here? What tree is she referring to when she says, God said that's off limits to me? What tree is in the middle of the garden, please? Based on number 5, tree of life. But they didn't eat from the tree of life. You all know they ate from the tree of knowledge. And it was the knowledge that they gained, the nefarious knowledge to transgress that first command. They rebelled against God. They had this awareness that they were not wearing proper clothing. And, you know, everything else came to be. Okay. But the tree of life, they were never told not to eat from the tree of life, were they? No. They were told not to eat from the tree of knowledge. But yet, Eve's response to the serpent was, no, no, the only tree that was verboten, the only tree that was forbidden to us, was the fruit of the tree in the middle of the garden. She doesn't mention it by name, but based on the first source, Genesis 2:9, the only location in the middle of the garden is the tree of life. So in other words, could the tree of knowledge be adjacent to the tree of life? Could they both kind of be located there? Of course. But the one that is described as being in the middle, betoch, is only a reference to the tree of life. Does this make any sense? No. So Rabbi Weinberg, my late Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, of blessed memory, he had an astounding insight here. You ready? There was one tree in the Garden of Eden. There was a tree of life, / tree of knowledge. If you ate from that tree with the kavanah, with the intention that it should be the tree of life, beautiful. It was a tree of life and you live forever. If you had nefarious intent and ate for it to acquire this cunning knowledge of the dark side of life and death, of good and evil, if that was your intent when you ate from it, the reality of the tree became the tree of knowledge. It was one tree. Now, that is incredible. Now, we don't have to go any farther than that, but you hear? In other words, a human being's mind has the ability to objectively or subjectively, maybe both, change a reality in our world. So that if Eve had, because she was the first one to imbibe, had she had the intention of Eitz HaChaim, Eitz HaChaim hi, lama chazikim ba, I want to have life, everything good, it would have been the tree of life. Everything would have been perfect. But she didn't. Because at the behest of the serpent, who is a metaphor for the evil inclination, the evil inclination whispered sweet nothings in her ear and got her to eat the fruit, and she had kavanah. What was her intent? That it should be good and evil. I want to know the dark side. Well, you know what, sweetheart? If you want to know the dark side, then that's what you're going to eat. If she had wanted the light, if she had wanted life, it would have been life. There was only one tree. Now, what that means for us, takeaway is very powerful. We in our own lives can take something, an object, that is neither good nor evil. But it could become good or evil depending on how you approach it, how you use it, what you intend to use it. So I'll give you one that's a great example that's very divisive in our society. Guns. I mean, I don't have to tell you that guns can murder innocent poor people all the time. And yet, we also know that guns can protect your life and your family from bad guys. So a gun itself is not necessarily good or evil. The intent and the usage of that gun defines whether the gun is good or evil, correct? So I'm just using that as a metaphor for how we have our society built. But in Judaism, it's even more profound. So in other words, I can approach something that is potentially a good deed. I'll give you an example. Let's say I want to be generous and give tzedakah. I want to give charity. It is incredible mitzvah. Right? It's the best to help someone else, whether with money, with your time. It's the best. You might say, well, Rabbi, how would you make that a malignant action? Well, what if I do something for somebody with strings attached because I want to define part of what they are by me? In other words, I want a piece of them. So I'm doing something And you've all probably been there. You probably had, if you think back to your childhood or growing up, you probably had people who offered to do something for you, but you just kind of turned them down because there was something a little icky, right? There was just something a little off, and you felt, you know what? Normally I would say yes, but I don't want to accept because I just, there's something off. I remember when I was a little boy. There was a kid, very wealthy family. His name was Alan. And I remember offering to do something for him. And I was like in seventh grade, you know? Like how nefarious could I be? I really was a cute little kid in seventh grade. And I offered something to Alan. And he was my classmate at the Tomatoro Day School. And he turned me down. And I remember him remarking, like, I don't want to owe you. And it was somehow ingrained by his family, because they were very well-to-do, that you don't accept someone else's offer of a kindness because they're going to come back expecting something from you. Even though that was clearly, in my mind, I just wanted to help him out. He refused my offer because in his mind, it came with strings and he didn't want to be beholden to me. He didn't want a part of his body to be justified by what I did. So I'll leave you with this final concept, okay? When we do a funeral, we've often heard that when we bury someone who's dead, we call it a chesed shel emet, a kindness that is pure, truthful. So why would that be? So often people will say, well, you know, if you're burying so-and-so person, they can't really pay you back. Therefore, it's a perfect action. I beg to differ. If I bury the Rothschild guy, I might have in mind, hey, you know what? The family is going to be very grateful, and I'll probably, you know, get a new Lamborghini in my driveway next week or something. You never know. It's possible, right? The Rothschilds will be grateful that I helped out dear old great-granddad, and, you know, who knows? Right? It's possible. You know what it really means? The person themselves, because they are deceased, you can't take part of that person by your action. In other words, if I'm burying that person, if I'm doing the tahara, the purification of their body, which is an incredible, difficult command that we have people right in our room now who do it, they're amazing people. Or I actually partake in the bear, make sure that there's whatever it is. I make food for the house, I go to the funeral, whatever. There's a myriad of ways that you can do a kindness to somebody who's deceased. The reason it's so perfect is because they're no longer living, you can't take something from that person, because they're no longer there to take from. That is why it's perfect. So what's the response? The response is that we have, as we've seen in our little Genesis invisible touch, we have incredible superpowers. We have a superpower to even be beyond God, to bring him joy by becoming ourselves. We discovered the beauty of living itself and when God rejoices over us. And then we discovered astoundingly that we have the power, almost like a God-like power, which God, it literally says that you will be like God to know the difference between good and evil. We have that God-like ability for ourselves, maybe for others, to make choices. And through our choices, take something that is benign, that is parv, that is neither good nor evil. And in our hands, we can choose tov. We can choose or. We can make it something fantastic. So my blessing for all of us for this new year, we should have many opportunities to take something special, to become ourselves through our learning, through our kindness, and to take things that are neutral, parv, and make them very tasty and delicious into something special. Thank you, everyone.